Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. March 28th, Monday, House Water Committee. We have two items on the agenda for today for public hearing. First item that we are going to hear is House Bill 2664, and Representative, please. You have your name on this bill, and so would you enlighten us as to what your...
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Mike Schaffler, State Representative, District 48, and I went through the House and I tried to find the best company I could to put on that bill. Anyway, the buoy bill is what it's called. Is it's kind of a response to or a compromise to Senate Bill 555, I think. Whatever the mixing zone bill number is. I don't think it's 555. That's pesticide use. Forgive me.
555.
But anyway, what it would do is folks that have a mixing zone permit in the rivers and waterways would have to mark that mixing zone with a buoy. And this came up in a conversation in the office with some nice folks. And when I was a kid growing up, it was kind of like Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer when I was a kid. And we were always in the rivers and the streams and fishing and swimming. And I can imagine, these are the rivers of Iowa, mind you, not the rivers of Oregon. But I thought, why not let fishermen and fisherwomen and kids out there swimming know that this is here, and the mixing zone, they have so many feet from the point of discharge to meet Environmental Protection Agency's water quality standards. Why not just give folks a heads up, especially if they're fishing for bass or swimming, that maybe there may be some standards that they may not want to be fishing in or swimming in, and just give them a heads up. That's pretty much was the thought behind this.
That's not it, because
I wanted to speak to the mixing zone too. I had a difficult time with the mixing zone bill because I don't want to carve the state of Oregon out of the rest of the country economically. We are having a hard time getting investment in this state, and even there's a report came out this weekend, I heard on the news, that even the jobs we are generating here in Oregon in our recovery aren't the kind of jobs we really need. They're low-income, service-related jobs, not the industry, manufacturing, family wage jobs we want to get. And then if we put a bill in that says, well, you have to be absolutely within all water quality, right at the point of discharge, that's going to make it very difficult just for existing companies to maintain, let alone for anyone thinking about where they're going to invest. They certainly aren't going to invest if those kind of stringent standards are put in place, especially when they can go right next door to Idaho, Washington, California, or anywhere, one of our neighbors, and invest there. So I just was looking for some kind of compromise, give people a heads up. You know, this it has a certain amount of time before it has to make Environmental Protection Agency standards. And if it doesn't do it after that space in the river or the waterway, then they can get a hefty fine or lose their permit. And to date, I have not had anyone come into my office show me evidence that there's anybody doing that. But I thought this would be a nice compromise, just to give people some awareness about what's going on. And they don't fishing for bass, especially warm water fish, would tend to linger and hang out and live and breed right there in that specific area. I personally wouldn't be fishing for bass or catfish there, or I wouldn't want my daughter swimming there. So it's kind of where I'm coming from with this. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I'm not a scientist.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, does this apply to ocean outfall lines?
I reckon it probably, if they have a mixing zone permit, yes.
Cities or industry, either one make no difference, huh?
I'm sorry, what?
Cities or industry, either one.
I think anybody that has a mixing zone permit, so it would be industry and municipalities.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Representative. And I know you are in a committee spending the people's money.
Yes, sir. That's quite
and,
right.
And so we'll let you get back to that, because it's an awful lot of money, and you've got to work hard in order to get it spent. So,
and Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for giving us a hearing. I know there were some folks that wanted to get a hearing, and you generously scheduled it, and I just wanted to give my appreciation for that.
Thank you, Representative.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Colleagues, we've got a page of individuals to testify on this, and we have what I think will be a very busy schedule today, so I'm going to ask all testimony to be limited to 3 minutes. Understanding that this is the first public hearing, this is not a work session, so if the purpose of the chair is to get some idea of the summary of issues that people might have on this particular bill, and for today that would be all we're kind of looking for. So with that, we apparently have a panel of Williams, Lawrence, and Hamilton. At least it kind of indicates that here. Would you please come up? We're not here. Travis Williams, Rhett Lawrence, and Jessica Hamilton. Okay. Since they're not in the room at the present time, they're passed on. We'll go to Jim DEQ, McCauley, and then I also have signed up Les Helgeson and John Ledger. And would you all come up, please, so that we can move? What, please, announcement by staff?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Also attached to your minimal packet today, I received an email this morning from Ed Hart, who is president of the Eastern Oregon Mining Association, providing you with some additional information on House Bill 2664.
Okay.
Thank you.
Jim, please proceed.
Great. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim McCauley, here today representing Department of Environmental Quality, Water Quality Division. Just a brief background in terms of what DEQ does in regard to water permitting. The Environmental Quality Commission adopts water quality standards to protect a variety of values, including human health and aquatic life. These standards are used to set discharge limits for individual permits granted to industrial and municipal wastewater discharges. And within those permits, DEQ can authorize mixing zones, which are areas in the river where water quality standards are relaxed so that the standards are met at the edge of the mixing zone as opposed to the end of the pipe. And as we understand the bill's intent, wastewater permit holders would be required to mark mixing zones with buoys, markers, or signs if their discharge meets those overall guidelines or triggers the marking. Where we're at on this is, I think, really just one issue that's come up for us. I mean, it's just a matter of adding this on to the permit requirement, but we made a couple of phone calls or some contact to the Marine Board and was given the information that in terms of navigable waters and the placement of buoys, there would likely be a process in order to have these placed in navigable waters, and it would likely require some additional follow-up. So that's really all I have today as far as to introduce an issue of just on navigability and making sure that whoever has the appropriate authority on qualifying these buoys or markers in the water, they'd be brought into this conversation.
Thank you, Jim. Questions for the department?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Yes. Thank you for testifying, Jim. I have a question. I think you probably gave us this. And you mentioned that other states, the zones vary from state to state. What do our neighboring states do in this regard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, in both Washington State and California, mixing zones are part of the wastewater permitting process, as well as throughout the nation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries, and I'll be very brief. And I do have a little bit of more information on how frequently these are used. I did find a survey, and they surveyed most of the states. I think around 40 responded, 46. And of the 46 responding states, 100% of them did allow mixing zones. 55% of the states, more than half, have mixing zones in 99 to 100% of their permits. And I think 67 of these states responding had mixing zones in 50% or more of their permits. So they're very commonly used. And I think the quick thing to remember about mixing zones is there are two kinds of standards. There's a discharge standard and an ambient standard for everything. And a discharge standard is like what can come out of the tailpipe of your car, and you get it checked, or how much can come out of your wood stove. You get that checked. An ambient standard is breathable air, for instance, which is maybe in a park or community area, not on the street. And there's an ambient standard for the river, too. And a mixing zone is really what happens between the discharge standard and the ambient standard. And over the years, the mixing zones have been shrinking pretty dramatically. And one of the things that we're interested in is Senate Bill 45, which actually increases our fees so the DEQ can do their permits. And when they go through the permits, typically they shrink the mixing zones because the technology improves, so they will look and see what your mixing zone looks like, and if the technology is improved, you get a smaller mixing zone. The issue on posting, I don't think it really affects the fish whether it's posted or not. And if it is a human health issue, I certainly think that if Department of Health has a concern about, for instance, eating contaminated fish, as in the slough, that I believe that's being posted now. If it isn't, it certainly should be. So I believe the Department of Health has authority to, where there is an actual health effect, to do the posting. Most mixing zones are harmless for people. They're for things like, if you discharge drinking water, you need a mixing zone, because there's chlorine in it that's harmless for you. You can go swimming in it, but it's a little hard on fish. We have mixing zones for the water when it's too pure. Some companies will take the water, they'll clean it up, use it for making something, and they'll discharge it. And because it's deionized, has no electrolytes in it, it's so pure it's hard on fish, they'll have a mixing zone. Many mixing zones are for heat. Oregon standards are very strict. And over the years, they'll get more strict. And we expect the mixing zones will get reduced. I certainly think it really doesn't accomplish anything to put a sign up saying there's a mixing zone. We'll have hundreds of them. Every municipality has a mixing zone where they discharge. But if there is a threat to public health, like bacteria, Portland, for instance, where I think they do post, then that makes sense for the Department of Health to look at that and post that. I don't think anyone would have any trouble with that. I think it's the issue of general posting for mixing zones that really doesn't get us where we want to go. That's all I have,
John.
Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate your testimony. Are there other questions? Les, if you...
I have a question for Dee here.
We'll come back to it. Please.
Thank you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Les Helgeson with the Native Fish Society. I'll make my comments brief here today. We support this bill, but our support is conditioned on the support of the other mixing bills, which are not at issue here today. We think this would be a step in the right direction. I acknowledge there are some problems being from the coast. I'm not sure buoys would have survived this weekend, but maybe there are different things we could do in the ocean.
It's difficult to even keep the navigational buoys up.
Right. I understand. So, with that, in the interest of time, I'll thank you and answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Representative Dingfelder has a
question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for DEQ, and I want to make sure I'm reading this bill right, Jim. My understanding by reading this bill is that buoys wouldn't be required for every wastewater discharge, it's only when they're in violation of water quality standards. Is that correct?
The read on the bill, Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, DEQ would be required to add this as a permit requirement for any discharge in a mixing zone that would violate water quality standards, plain and simple. And that would be across the board for all constituents. and for any industrial municipal source that has a mixing zone that has those relaxed standards until the edge of the zone.
Okay, so follow-up?
Follow-up.
So that would be required in every permit. However, the permittee would not have to put these buoys in unless they were, the way I'm reading this, says markers or signs that designate the area of the waters that fail to meet the standards for water quality. So would that mean DEQ would be coming out monitoring, or the companies would be doing self-monitoring and then have to install buoys if they were not meeting their permit designation?
Okay. Chair Jensen, Rep. Dingfelder, I think what it comes down to is if they meet an end of pipe requirement for a water quality standard, they wouldn't have to have buoys marking a physical mixing zone. And they would have to do that through whatever technology would be available to them, or perhaps an alternate treatment process.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think there's a bitter point of confusion with the term standards. But you have to remember there are two standards. There's your discharge standard and there's the ambient mm-hmm. standard. And so unless your discharge standard is so strict that is essentially the analog in air would be breathable air coming out of your car, or it was so strict that coming out of the municipality, the sewage treatment system, it was essentially clean enough to meet right at that discharge point. It was essentially, you know, met all federal in-stream ambient standards, essentially pristine. Then you have an area between where you discharge and where you apply the standard. And that area is the mixing zone. So when we talk about like a violation of water quality standards, what we're really looking at is the place between the discharge. You're not in violation. You're meeting your discharge standard. And then out here, there's an ambient water quality standard for fish. And the two are different because most people can't discharge water that's super clean, so it'd make the same as what you want for the fish. So the mixing zone is that area in between. And I think where we went into problems with the words like violation. And the bill is written, it would apply certainly to heat. You know, if you discharge something warm, you might have a discharge standard of 65 degrees, but the standard for the stream is 50 degrees. So you either have to chill your discharge, which happens, or you have a mixing zone where it cools down through that area, and by the time you get out to this specified area that the DQ sets, they tell you how big it can be, and they tighten it up, then you have to cool down to that temperature. And this bill would say you'd have to put up a plaque or something saying there's a discharge here that's too warm.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. And we've got Dave Kessler, is that correct? Catherine Van Atta, Tom Quintrell. Good afternoon. Dave, is that correct?
Kelsey.
Yeah.
Dave Kelsey.
Please.
I represent the small-scale miners in the state of Oregon. This is just a forefront right now with House Bill 64, that is going to imply that I put up buoys for my small-scale suction dredge mining or placer mining in general. Right now the DEQ also has other bills and amendments on the table that will require me to walk 300 feet down into a mixing zone to determine turbidity. Now, turbidity right now, according to the state of Oregon, is antimineral water is cloudy. I have the USGS studies right now that basically state my water in Oregon on my mining claim on 23 miles of this riverfront in the North Santiam. I represent 1,100 feet of my mining claim. My discharge mixing zone is less than 15 feet on average. Now, the DEQ says I need to walk down 300 feet to make sure my mixing zone is clear. What they don't recognize, though, is that they're implying that I'm going to also have to not only monitor for water turbidity, but now I'm going to have to put a buoy out there. I've got pictures and documentation going back 2 years that shows the recreational, general recreating public out there will come to my mining claim right now on the North San Diem, and they'll use it, and they're swimming alongside my mining operation right in that water. Turbidity is not the issue, and the mixing zone is not the issue. It's now I've got to put buoys How am I going to anchor these buoys? With anchors to the bottom, to rocks, where people are walking, climbing, sitting? If you look at the way this affects us, I would recommend that we have all the exemptions set forth for small-scale placer mining operations, whether it be sluicing, rocket boxing, dredge operations. Anything that is exempt now currently under the written rule should be exempt from this buoy operation. The previous starting gentleman that came up here and spoke, he spoke about fishing next to a discharge point and how we all want clean water. Well, we do want clean water. We've got 40,000-plus visitors right now every year to the Opal Creek watershed. Every one of those visitors up there put sunscreen on their bodies. Sunscreen's one of the most toxic things you could put in the water, but we don't regulate them. I would like right now to notice that DEQ has all these great plans, and I support them, a lot of them. But this is a bad bill for small-scale miners in the state of Oregon at this time. A buoy is just another hindrance to my rights. Thank you.
Thank you. It was Dave, is that?
Yes.
That's correct? Okay. Thank you, Dave. Catherine?
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, Catherine Venata representing the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. I come before you today to oppose House Bill 2664. This bill assumes that violations are occurring of the water quality standards in Oregon in its whereas clauses in lines 5 to 11, and we disagree with those findings of policy for the state. Secondly, we believe the bill is unnecessary. We believe it's unnecessary because the DEQ wastewater database, which you can find on their website, already includes longitude and latitude coordinates for all permits issued. And if you go and look at the Willamette Basin, you can find those. Secondly, navigation charts for navigable waterways already note the locations of diffusers. Third, buoys or other markers would present a potential safety hazard to recreational users of water bodies, and furthermore, lower the beneficial use of recreation in our view, because recreation is a designated beneficial use. We also believe that buoys or other markers would create visual clutter to Oregon's waterways and lower the narrative beneficial use of aesthetics. Finally, we think that DEQ cannot issue a permit, especially an NPDES permit, that allows a violation of water quality standards to occur, as this bill would state, because you can't legally issue a permit that allows a violation of a water quality standard. And when you hear talk today about exactly what is a mixing zone and where is it, please realize that especially in NPDES permits, that the dimensions are specifically called out for those about where you comply with what exact standard. So I'd like to add that to the mix. But we would encourage you to oppose this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Catherine. Tom?
Yes, Chairman Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Tom Quintel, and I am opposed to Senate Bill 2664. And this statement that I'm going to read here is probably the one that you received from Ed Hart. I'm a small-scale miner. I have multiple mining claims. And I'm also a member of the current permit committee with DEQ and about 1,500 miners here in Oregon. So I know that there's some real concern with putting an additional burden or hardship on the small businesses that we represent as small-scale miners. So this letter concerns the water quality within mixing zones that is necessary to protect the beneficial uses, including the human health and public, who has a strong interest in knowing the locations of mixing zones by the placement of buoys, markers, or signs which will indicate the waste contained in discharge that caused the waters to fail to meet the standards for water quality and purity. Now, the tailings of waste for gold placer minings are classified as a non-hazardous in the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, Subtitle D, and implemented in 40 CFR 261.4, paragraph B, 3, and 7. Also, the effects of small-scale gold placer mining are exempted from the Clean Water Act, believe it or not, implemented in 40 CFR 440.140 and 40 CFR 440 subpart M. Based on this and that mining is a beneficial use under the 1872 mining laws, which the state of Oregon upholds, we believe that small-scale gold placer mining should have a clause that state any discharge from small gold placer mining and suction dredges with up to 10 inches inside hose diameter are exempted from placing buoys or signage or marking of the mixing zones of the plumes that exceed the 10% above background for water quality. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Representative Nolan has joined us. She'd like to testify on this bill, if you would. Please, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. I'm Mary Nolan. I represent the House District that includes Southwest Portland, including most of my district has a border on the Willamette River and several small creeks that flow into the Willamette River flow through my district. I wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill and, in fact, for bringing it to the legislature. I think it's an issue that we ought to talk about, and I urge you to find a way to bring this issue forward in actual legislation that we enact. I understand that there can be some difficulties for businesses when faced with a change or a heightening of expectation for their participation in managing and stewarding the environment. And I do not want to trivialize that. I think it's important that we find a balance for both protecting the natural resources and also creating an atmosphere, an economic atmosphere that supports our current businesses and provides an appealing place for new businesses that will employ additional Oregonians to come to our state. I want to give you just very briefly some of my experience in a regulatory role managing all businesses within the City of Portland's watershed when I was Director of Environmental Services for the city, and we faced very similar issues to what this bill proposes. Indeed, I was on the receiving end of a DEQ mandate for posting and providing visual barricades for outflows from our municipal sewer system. I didn't like it very much when they imposed it on us, so I can very much sympathize with people who are asking that we not do it here. But beyond not liking it, and once we got around to saying, okay, we have to do this, and actually getting around to seeing the value of it, it gave us an opportunity, although I didn't call it an opportunity at the time, it forced me at the time, to look at the way we were doing our business differently and to explore much more rigorously than we would otherwise have done alternative ways of managing our effluent into the rivers and to the Columbia Slough and other small streams. The city's municipal sewer system was the extension of DEQ in managing the commercial operations that used our sewer system as a mechanism for either treatment or discharge. So we had to then go turn around and regulate businesses. And in that experience, something that directly relates to the kind of legislation you're thinking about here, when we asked businesses to look more rigorously at their treatment, many times we found that businesses because we had posed the question differently than they had been dealing with it before, actually found techniques, technologies, and manufacturing processes that they hadn't pursued before because they didn't have to. And although it wasn't universal, many of those instances resulted in efficiencies for those businesses that covered the cost of the change that they had to make in their manufacturing process. Now, how could they do that? The principal way in which that occurred for businesses, in my experience, is that they were able to remove from their waste stream materials that actually had an economic value. We are finding over and over again that things we used to just throw out as unusable or as garbage actually has some economic value. And as we look at changes in the way we conduct our manufacturing businesses, we find value in that. A lot of it's in metal, some of it's gold plating in some of the manufacturing processes, or copper or aluminum or some of the more exotic metals. Pulling those out of the waste stream and reusing them in their manufacturing process in many instances can cover the cost or nearly cover the cost of the changes that need to be made in order to meet the standards. I don't mean to suggest that this is a totally painless process, but I do want to commend you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for putting this idea out for consideration and hopefully for moving some version of it forward. As I close, and then I'll take questions if there are any, I would encourage you to think about ways that we can set a vision for our the businesses operating in Oregon that looks to the future and positions them to be competitive not only with the way they've done business in the past, but the way they're going to need to do business nationally and internationally in the future. I would submit to you, for example, that this state would not have been as nearly as successful as we have been in attracting and growing our own high-tech industries if we had not, a generation or two ago, taken the difficult steps of cleaning up our Willamette River and creating a Willamette Valley that was attractive to the kind of high-tech businesses that have since come to locate here. We probably wouldn't be able to be attracting businesses now to other parts of the state, for example, the Medford area, if we had ignored the need to clean up the airshed there and remove the threat of traffic restrictions and other travel restrictions in that area, which now allows us to grow more businesses and to create more jobs that employ Oregonians. And I'd certainly submit that our ability to be a very attractive and economically vibrant tourist destination is directly dependent on our willingness and ability to find ways to preserve the environmental values that make that industry want to grow here. Thank you for your leadership on this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions for the representative? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this point, we have Jeff Boatwright. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Hello. How are you? Thank you, Chairman Jensen, members of the committee. I think what's important here is that
Jeff, for the record, please.
Yeah, my name is Jeff Boatwright, Albany, Oregon. Citizen. Yeah. The intent of the bill is basically advertising for the public for safety considerations, and centered around what I believe should be hazardous substances. And the Environmental Quality Commission, they derive their basis for their authority and the limit of their authority for establishing the water quality standards that the state has. And they cite to do that It's Clean Water Act, Title 33, 1321, and Chapter 26. It was it's based on oil and hazardous substances, basically. Any substance in a quantity would be a hazardous substance if it actually presents a, quote, imminent and substantial danger to, unquote, to humans, the aquatic ecosystem, or the stream itself. One particular problem I see is that, I mean, as far as advertising for humans with this bill, is that it doesn't take into account that some of our state's water quality standards don't present an imminent and substantial danger. And as already noted, I'm referring to turbidity. It's just basically the cloudiness of water. It's not considered a pollutant by the EPA. It's more a condition of the water. Currently, the flawed state standard that we have now for turbidity allows only a 10% increase in the cloudiness of the water compared to its natural or ambient condition. Most times of the year, in majority of Oregon streams, that level of cloudiness is almost nothing. So an 11% increase in nearly clear water is equal to an amount that is not generally visible to human eye and under no circumstances would present an imminent or substantial danger to humans or the aquatic ecosystem. Yet it's a felony violation under Oregon law to surpass that threshold, and would also, under the way this current bill is written, would necessitate the warning flag, signs, or buoys. So I think that the bill should either be amended to only address toxic substances, it'd be better if the standards were modified to actually represent hazardous substances. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. And now, at the request of the committee staff, to allow some people to testify who weren't here when they were called, Mr. Williams, Mr. Lawrence, and Mr. Hamilton, or Ms. Hamilton, excuse me.
Chair Jensen and committee members, my name is Travis Williams, and I represent Willamette Riverkeeper.
And before you begin, folks, recognize that we ask everybody to be under 3 minutes on their...
Great, I can do that.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you for circling back to our names since we weren't here at the beginning. I think we need to take a step back and looking at what this House Bill 2664 actually asked for. The state of Oregon, the DEQ, will tell you that, yes, they implement a system that allows these areas called mixing zones in the Willamette River and in many other rivers. When you are paddling your canoe or your kayak or your drift boat, rowing it through these areas, you do not necessarily know that they are there. These are areas where the state of Oregon allows a permittee, could be a city, could be an industry, large and small, to discharge waste that exceeds standards by a very significant degree. That's the whole idea. Then they let the river do the rest of the work to try to dilute this back to the standard at the edge of these mixing zones. Keep in mind these mixing zones can be 75,000 square feet in volume. In some cases they can be nearly over the entire, say half the width of a river. That could be a tributary to the Willamette or the main stem Willamette. So in our view, given all the calls that we get, and I know state agencies get these calls, asking questions about, well, what areas are safe? What is discharged into the river? How do I know when I'm out there? Your typical answer is a very lengthy one because, again, these areas are not readily advertised to the general public that's using the river, either on the bank or floating in their powerboat or anchored if they're fishing for spring chinook or if they're trolling. There are any variety of scenarios that allow people to be on the Willamette River today. So it seemed to us a pretty darn basic thing to say, let's put a sign or a buoy adjacent or in the middle of these mixing zones to allow the public to find out about what it is, the fact that it's there, and what may be in that mixing zone. We think that asking for this type of a buoy or marker is pretty darn basic. I mean, it doesn't take a lot. This is not super science here. This is not asking for another study. It's simply identifying where they are. Now, we've heard some mention of how expensive this is. Well, I think one thing we could do easily is say, okay, this doesn't apply to temperature or turbidity. And what we're really trying to get at here is persistent toxins in the environment. They're toxic to human health, potentially, through fish consumption, that cause issues with the health of wildlife, fish, macroinvertebrates, you name it. All of this right out here in the Willamette River today that happens to be running pretty high. So if you go down to Ace Hardware Store, you can price cable, plastic-coated cable, $1.49 a foot. You can anchor that to something that would keep it stationary in the Willamette. So let's say the average depth of the Willamette right out here, it's about 20, 25 feet, sometimes down to 10 and less. You can go down to your marine supply store and buy a buoy, 20 inches by 20 inches, bright orange, $64. And I'm sure you'll find others around that price range. But I think you understand my point. This is not something that is extremely expensive. This is not something that cannot be done easily. All you got to go, all you have to do is attach those together, attach it to the weight, and lower it into the mixing zone, clearly identified. Again, this is not rocket science. So I know there are volunteer groups out there today that would partner with industry and say, look, you know, we're just trying to identify these areas for the public good. And there's over 100 in the Willamette system, not to mention 300 mixing zones statewide.
You're running well beyond your
okay,
3 minutes.
I'll close with this. You know, it seems ironic to me that some would say this creates visual clutter. Does that not make the inverse argument that, my goodness, these areas are out there today and nobody seems to know because you can't see them, the discharges are underwater. Let's mark them, even if they're every few miles. Let's mark them so when that family is paddling or fishing down to Willamette in July here in just a few months, they'll be able to know and they'll be able to be informed. So I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and thanks for letting me go over time.
Thank you, Travis. Representative
Mr. Chair, out of curiosity, how do you anchor a 20 by 20 buoy to a creek that isn't 20 feet deep?
Well, 20 inches by 20 inches.
Well,
we're talking
whatever it is.
We're talking all about this size.
How do you anchor it to a creek that isn't very deep?
Well, I would imagine you just reduce the amount of cable. Okay. I mean, really, that's all we're talking. It can bob in the creek, or in the case of a creek, it would make much more sense to place it on the shoreline. Remember, we're talking about signs and or buoys here. It's stated on section 1, line 21.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would your reasoning also apply to mixing zones in the ocean?
Yeah, it would.
In the Pacific Ocean, and you're going to
I suppose it would, but I think the majority of the mixing zones that at least we know about are in the river systems in the interior state of Oregon or in those tributaries or those rivers flowing out into the ocean. So, yes. Perhaps there's a scenario that I haven't identified that, you know, if you're dealing with four or 500 feet of water, I can imagine you're looking at something different there.
Yeah, there is mixing zones in the ocean for cities and industry along the coast that have outfall lines that go out into the ocean.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point. Perhaps it could be amended to apply to those areas that have a lower volume of water, such as our river systems.
Thank you. Rhett.
Thanks, Chair Jensen, members of the committee.
And your previous person took 2 minutes.
So I'll take one. Rhett Lawrence, I'm an environmental advocate with Osberg Gordon State Public Interest Research Group. Travis covered probably most of the points I would have wanted to make anyway, so I'll just reiterate a couple of points. This bill was not meant to address heat or turbidity, only toxic chemicals, so we'd be happy to offer amendments to clarify that that's all that was meant to be addressed by this bill. Second, one of the previous testifiers had mentioned that you can go online right now and find out the latitude and longitude for all these permits. You can go online and find out the latitude and longitude of the facility, but in terms of finding out where the mixing zone is or what the mixing zone is for or how big it is or any of that, none of that information is available on the web. To get that information, you pretty much have to go down to the DEQ office, pull the file, go through even the permit application to look at, you know, the modeling data that's been submitted. So, you know, not only are these things not marked off or signed in any way, you know, a visible way on the river, it's actually quite difficult to get that information by any means. So I just wanted to get that on the record. And, you know, again, sort of the bottom line on this, I think, is that the state DEQ sets these water quality standards for a reason, you know, to protect human health and the environment. And so it just stands to reason to me that if facilities are going to be allowed to discharge waste in excess of those standards that we set for these chemicals, people should have the right to know about that and, you know, choose not to fish or swim where these areas are. And just right now we have no way of knowing that. So
okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Rhett. And I managed to save a little bit of the time for you, Jessica, after the faux pas that we started out
I'll
with.
Try. So. Sorry, thank you. I'll talk quickly. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I'm Jessica Hamilton. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. And before I explain professionally why I'm here, I do have a personal story. I used to be on a competitive water ski team at the University of North Carolina, which is in the Final Four, by the way. And in part of my basketball, sir. Anyway,
my condolences.
Yeah. And as a part of that water ski team, it would be my job or my passion, I guess, to go around the buoys and try and complete a water ski course.
Just a slight interruption.
Yes,
is
sir.
That what happened to the academic quality of all those triangle universities we had there? Now that they've discovered this other thing and they're spending all their time and money for that.
On the basketball, sir? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, okay. just curious.
Of course. I understand. It was a good school. But in my free time, I water skied, and I've continued to ski here in Oregon. I go on the Willamette River frequently, even all seasons, and I go in areas that I know are fairly dangerous to my health. And I think on a personal level, this bill would be give me a peace of mind if I knew which areas were blocked off with buoys, and I would know not to go on the inside of that area. But a professional instance, the Oregon League of Conservation Voters established an agenda for this session that we're really excited about. And it's a coalition of 70 different environmental groups called the Oregon Conservation Network, of which Willamette River Keepers and Osperg are members. And the idea of addressing the mixing zone problem in the rivers across Oregon is definitely a priority for this coalition. So I just wanted to lend my voice of support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two of the three of you have talked about the designated areas with buoys. As I read the bill, and I'd like your comment on this, as I read the bill, it doesn't actually require the use of any particular system of markings, except that it's got to be buoys, markers, or signs that designate the area of the waterways that fail to meet the standards. Now, if I read the bill correctly, you don't have to stick a buoy out in the middle of the river someplace to do this. You could do it with a sign on the shore that says, out to the middle of the river and down 400 feet is the mixing zone for this noxious chemical. Would that be sufficient or not?
Yes, that's completely sufficient, and that gets back also, Representative Barnhart, to Representative Dalto's question. I think that there's flexibility in there. If it's easier for you to put a buoy in, then great. You can also mark these mixing zones, again, on the shoreline, and there's numerous instances of pretty simple signs being placed throughout the Willamette system, whether you're looking at cables crossing under the river where you don't want to anchor to pull them up, or various cities that have signs. And the good thing about those is typically with signs of that nature, you pretty much eliminate issues of high water carrying them away and having an ongoing maintenance issue with those. But definitely that flexibility is there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jessica, just a quick closing here. I would welcome you to come over to the Columbia River in eastern Oregon for your water skiing, and advise you that all you'd have to be concerned about there would be the plumes from the atomic energy facility
at Hanford, yes, sir.
Getting into
Chair
the water.
And also the barges.
If that wasn't a concern, and, you know, for you, I mean, if that's, you know, then the possibility of a failure of the burning facility for the sarin at all there. So,
thank you, sir. I'll come.
But Mr. Chair,
Yes.
If she goes up onto the Snake River there, just below Ice Harbor Dam, then the plumes from the nuclear plants won't be a problem. Of course, that's not necessarily right in your district, I understand, but
no, that's true. And of course, we wouldn't get the benefit of the economic, as Representative Nolan was talking about economic benefits from that. So we have to confine it to this side of the border there. Thank you very much
for
your testimonies. And we're going to close the public hearing then on House Bill 2664 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3008. Is that correct?
3038.
Okay. First, Willie Tiffany from League of Oregon Cities. Rick Glick from Davis Wright Termain, and Todd Heidrich. I got that wrong. From Tualatin Valley District. And if you would please, your names for the record and.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll try to move this along. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you very much for conducting this hearing on this very, very important bill for us this session. What we tried to do, this bill is of paramount importance to a number of districts and all municipalities in Oregon, but we tried to condense our testimony into two panels for the committee here to thoroughly cover the issues for us. So I'll start with just a little bit of background. Municipalities in Oregon and in the entire West, in fact, have been treated a little bit differently than other water right holders under Western water law. This concept is usually referred to as the growing communities doctrine, and in some Western states it's actually written in policy and statute, but usually it's addressed through different statutory statuses for municipal water rights. And municipalities are treated a little bit differently because they do have to accommodate for growth in their communities. Here in Oregon, we have land use requirements which require municipalities to supply 20 years of residential growth and industrial growth, and they must have the infrastructure to meet that growth, including water supplies. Also, municipalities accommodate a variety of uses, unlike other water users, from irrigation to domestic to industrial, and in some cases, in-stream or aesthetic-type uses. And then also, municipalities must have redundancy in their systems to accommodate for emergency needs, for depletion of certain sources. We do have a duty to serve that other entities don't, and other panel members will expand on that. In Oregon, we have a unique way of accomplishing these goals. Just real briefly, the old process by which municipalities extended their permit basically was every 5 years the department would ask the municipality if they would continue to like to extend that permit, and if they said yes, that was the process. Well, that has vastly changed today. And we have a real unique process here. Others will go into it more
detail. Could you tell me why that's vastly changed today?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I believe, as you know, the department received an opinion or a couple of opinions from the Attorney General's office telling them that the way they had been enacting the extension process, not only for municipalities, in fact, that it was originally a case arose around irrigation rights, was possibly unlawful. And at that point in time, the department engaged in a massive rulemaking process for other water right holders and for municipal water right holders as well. And so that's where these new processes come from. For municipalities now, basically, when you come into the department for an extension of time, you can request the extension of time necessary beyond 5 years or below 5 years that you will need to develop that water right. However, that does not give you any access to that water. That water right is then, or that extension, excuse me, is then conditioned on the approval of an approved water management and conservation plan. And we have some experts to talk to you today a little bit about those plans. But basically, within those plans, a municipality must describe how much water they will need over the next 20 years within that extension. And after a negotiation and approval of the plan, the departments will allow that municipality to develop that water over that 20-year period within five-year benchmark check-ins. And they must commit to extensive conservation and management practices. Again, we'll talk a little bit about that in the future. This last year we had a court case, and that's why we're here today with House Bill 3038. I won't go into detail about the case. However, it basically required that all municipalities complete construction of a water permit within 5 years of obtaining that permit. That's a difficult situation for us given the way the department has treated municipalities and put them in the situation they're in today with their current extensions. So the intent behind this bill, Mr. Chair, is not to expand the policy of the state of Oregon with respect to municipalities or the authority of municipalities to develop water to any greater extent than they have been able to in the past. And in doing so, the bill as drafted, what we try to do is four basic things. First, remove that five-year completion requirement and put that in the discretion of the department. The second thing we try to do is redefine construction. To define construction as to the types of things that municipalities typically have to do in conjunction with building waterworks. The third thing we do is put in statute for the first time ever the requirement that municipalities have an approved water management conservation plan so that for these longer term extensions they must comply with not only the planning process required in a management conservation plan, but commit to those conservation measures so that they're developing new sources in conjunction with conserving the sources they have. And then lastly, and most importantly for our membership, is validation of those extensions that have occurred in the past. In drafting this bill, we've been very, very open, Mr. Chair, and shared our initial drafts and our LC drafts with other interest groups out there, and I want to at this point commend Water Watch, who has dealt with us in very good faith during this process. Over the last couple months, we've been knowing that they might have concerns, or obviously have concerns about this bill. We've been trying to work with them and their staff and their board president, and lobbyists have been very helpful. However, we have not come to an agreement. Instead, we have listened to their concerns and tried to address many of them. We've also tried to address many of the department's concerns and some of the members of this committee. In doing so, the committee has before them the Dash 1 amendments, and they're the culmination of that work. The Dash 1 amendments, although lengthy, really do four things. And Mr. Glick will talk in more detail, but at the request of the department and Water Watch, they were concerned. I wouldn't say at the request. Their concerns regarding the open-endedness of the extension time limit, we went ahead and put a limit on that. Vice Chair Dingfelder, in particular, was concerned about our definition of construction, so we have taken that out of the bill under the amendments. Also, Water Watch was concerned about a presumption of good cause that was in the bill. And again, I commend them because that was, in our estimation upon second reading, a little overreaching in terms of where policy has dealt with municipalities. And so we have taken that out. And then the department wished to have an emergency clause because they have a number of these permits or permit extensions pending at the moment. So we went ahead and add that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just introduce our panel with me. To my right is Rick Glick from Davis Wright Tremaine, represents a number of municipalities and has helped us draft this bill with him. Is Todd Heigergen from Tualatin Valley Water District to talk to us a little bit about how municipalities develop water. Second, on our second panel, we have Paul Eckley, the operations manager from here in Salem, to talk about municipal water planning in general. Doug Riggs, and I believe the community staff will have on the phone for us Patrick Griffiths from the City of Bend, who has the second approved water management conservation plan under the new rules, to kind of walk the committee through that process. And then Rebecca Geisen from the Portland Water Bureau to talk a little bit about Portland's perspective. Before turning it over to Rick, just also wanted to let you know I had given committee members a copy of this document, the Water Management and Conservation Plans, a guidebook for Oregon municipal water suppliers. When we went through this rulemaking process, we knew these plans were going to be very extensive and very difficult for municipalities, particularly small ones, to implement. So along with the Special Districts Association, the Water Utility Council, we hired a consultant to work with the department to put this guidebook together, and it can kind of give the committee members a little bit of depth in terms of what municipalities need to go through in order to get an approved plan. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Buck.
Thank you. Please proceed, Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Glick of the Davis Wright Tremaine Law Firm in Portland, and as Willie mentioned, I am a water lawyer representing municipalities around the state in the development of new water supplies. As Willie also mentioned, this bill is not intended as a major shift in policy, but rather as a continuation of longstanding policy upon which many communities throughout the state have relied for many, many years. And by adopting this legislation, the legislature puts itself squarely in the mainstream of other Western states under similar water laws that are trying to recognize the special considerations that municipalities have. And in Oregon, that problem is particularly acute. There is a tension between the land use planning requirements that statute requires of local governments, where they have to have at least a 20-year supply of buildable land and the infrastructure to support that, including water supplies, on the one hand. On the other hand, we have the water law, which is based on prior appropriation, meaning first in time is first in right. So when you file the water right application, that locks in a priority date that stays with the application until it is permitted and then forever. The advantage of that is that it secures that water supply against all future comers so that the community knows that when it's there, it will be there. The tension is that we have this obligation to work on a 20-year or more planning cycle on the one hand. On the other hand, we have to apply for the water to secure the priority date, but we have to do that before the cities are ready, in fact, to develop that water right. And the reason is that most of these projects are revenue bond funded. You have to spend the money within a certain period of time after issuing the revenue bonds. And so the object would be to lock the water right in place. When the time comes to develop the water right, then you issue revenue bonds and you go through the development process. That includes a lot of other state and federal permits as well as the water right, all of which are very expensive to get and need the revenue bond financing to do that, particularly the federal permitting, which requires an environmental impact analysis to go along with it. So in trying to plan responsibly for the future in this system with the tensions built into it, the solution has been to file for the water right, hold the water right in place, and then develop the water when there are sufficient ratepayers there to pay back the debt service and when the community is actually ready to build the facility. It has often been said that, well, if that's what municipalities want to do, why don't they just use the reservation law? There is a law that says that communities can request that the Water Resources Commission adopt a rule that would reserve water for municipal storage purposes. It's only available for storage into the foggy future. The difficulty for that for communities is that it's a rulemaking, and that which the Water Resources Commission adopts, the Water Resources Commission can unadopt at some later time. It's not good enough, frankly, for communities to invest the hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes millions of dollars, in locking in a water supply and knowing that it will be there when the time comes to develop it. So the plan had been to file these water rights and then apply to the Water Resources Commission, for department rather, for extensions of time. These have been liberally granted over the years, and they have been relied upon by the communities that would in fact occur, because that was the state of practice. At the time the water rights were acquired, they were acquired fully within the legal framework. The extensions were granted within the legal framework, as everybody understood it at the time, and so that's why they're in that situation. The viability of these older water rights that have been issued and extensions granted on these older water rights is called into question by the case that Willie mentioned, the Water Watch of Oregon versus Water Resources Commission. This is the case that involved the Coos Bay North Bend Water Board. I'm not going to get into the detail of that except to suggest that what the case seemed to take off on was the fact that the record in that case showed there would be no physical construction in the first 5 years. And for that reason, the permit was held improperly issued. The implications here are for all of those communities around the state, and there are many, that have had permits issued where the record may not be clear about whether there was construction in the first 5 years. For all of those, this case suggests that perhaps those extensions were improperly granted. If the records in those cases show that there was never the intent to begin construction within the first 5 years, which would not be uncommon, I don't think, then it's possible that the case could mean that those permits were invalid from the get-go, from the time that they were adopted. So because of that, municipal water providers need clarification on the status of their existing undeveloped water rights and the path that would be there for securing long-term supplies into the future. And so what the bill does, and I've laid it out for you in the written testimony that I've provided here today, what the bill does is first it moves the commencement of construction date from 5 years from issuance of the permit to 20. This would apply to permits applied for after the effective date of this act. Extensions of time to complete construction would be based upon a showing of good cause. Originally in the law, good cause was presumed if construction was going on. That's been eliminated in this bill. And the Water Resources Department has extensive rules defining what good cause would mean and a clear process to move through. Extensions of time would also be conditioned upon the issuance of water management and conservation plans. I want to stress to the committee that these are not window dressing kinds of requirements. As the guidebook that Willie handed out, and as you'll hear from municipalities that are going through or just completed the planning process, these are substantive plans with substantive conservation measures and benchmarks to work against. So these are actually intended to achieve conservation and come with a price tag. These two conditions on extensions, good cause and the approval of the Water Management and Conservation Plan, would apply to extension requests that are currently pending before the Water Resources Department, and there are a good many in that situation, and to those that are applied for after the effective date of this act. In recognition of the reliance that municipalities have placed on the previous system for decades previous, this bill would confirm the validity of the originally granted permits and the extensions that were granted, so it would eliminate all the uncertainty created by the case that the Court of Appeals just decided. Because the Water Resources Department has before it a great many municipal extension applications, the bill also includes an emergency clause to take it forward. So in conclusion, House Bill 3038 would preserve needed and irreplaceable water rights. I say irreplaceable because in most instances, new water rights have been filed for after the water right permits have been issued. And most Oregon streams, I'm sure everyone will agree, are over-appropriated, and there just isn't water available for new applications in the majority of cases. So in fairness of the communities that have long relied upon the existing system, we think it's fair to maintain the existing process, and it's necessary to protect the public investment and reliance in that process. With that, I'll be happy to close and take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Glick, I was trying to be a good listener and a good reader at the same time.
On the last page of your testimony, you mentioned substantive conservation measures with benchmarks. Is that in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, what the bill would require is that the water conservation and management plan be part of the extension process. Water Resources Department has rules that lay out what goes into a plan of this sort.
And those rules are, if I may follow, Mr. Chair, thank you. Those rules are in effect now. This is not a part of the new bill. These are rules that are in effect at this time. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Pollock, and you will excuse me, Todd, for Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been thinking, Mr. Glick, about an issue which I'm not sure you've addressed directly and you probably have thought about. And I have to say I'm not familiar with the case in detail. I know about it, of course, but not in detail. To what extent does this bill, if at all, threaten the existing property rights of people who have filed subsequent to the filings which might not be valid under this case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart.
If at all.
If I understand the question, maybe I'll state it back to you, see if I do understand the question. And that is that if, in fact, these longstanding, undeveloped municipal water rights are declared invalid, and this bill were to say that, in fact, they were valid, would this prejudice later water right holders? Well, I guess it would. I don't think it's a denial of any property rights because the later given water rights were always conditioned on the fact that the prior water rights take precedence. So junior water right holders always take a water right with the understanding that they will get water only if the senior water right holder gets his water first. Does that make sense?
I certainly, if I may, Mr. Chair, I certainly understand the point you're making, but I would insert the word valid in there in your statement at several spots. Certainly a junior water right holder is subject to takings by a senior valid water right holder. But what about a senior invalid water right holder or non-holder, as the case may be? I don't know the answer to the question. It may not be something that you've thought about. But it's one that I wonder about, and whether the legislature actually has the authority to do what you're asking it to do or not, in the face of the potential that this may be a taking of the supposed junior water right holders' water rights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I appreciate your concern. I do not believe that a takings would have occurred if the legislature does have the authority to adopt retroactive legislation. And what you would be doing, actually, is clarifying that these water rights lawfully issued at the time and lawfully extended at the time are what they purport to be. And in fairness, we think that's the right outcome because communities around the state have relied upon those water rights being there. And everybody else that came after came with the understanding those water rights were in place.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That gets me around a conundrum that I perhaps made up for myself.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been brought to my attention that the city of Adair Village has a permit dating back to July of 1971 for, what is that, 82? Oh, heck of a lot of water. Is that cubic feet? Anyway, I think it's 60 million gallons a day. So how is it that they can maintain that? As I understand it, that village has not really been a municipality for many, many years. So how is it that they can maintain that water right after 30-some years?
Representative, Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, I'm not familiar with the specific circumstances of the Adair Village water right, but there are many instances of water rights that had been issued permits granted with the understanding that the development would occur sometime later. And the evaluation that the Water Resources Department did in looking at extensions is whether the city had a water development plan that it was moving forward on. It was not a very strict scrutiny on those five-year increments of extension.
And so how would this, if I may follow up, how would this bill improve that?
What this bill would do, excuse me, Representative Jensen and Representative Tomei, what this bill would do is for, on a going forward basis, for extensions that are pending now or that will be applied for after the effective date of the Act, there will be substantive requirements that will have to be met in order to use the water. The principal measure is the Water Management and Conservation Plan, which again I would like to stress is a real substantive sort of plan with teeth in it that requires that certain actions be taken before the water actually is put to use. That's the benefit that we would have today.
But if I may follow up, that bill is, that requirement is current. That's nothing new with this bill.
What's new in the bill would be that requirement would become statutory now. So it would not be an option for the Water Resources Department to change its mind on requiring those plans. It would be part of the law.
If I may follow up, one more last question. So how the city of Adair Village, how is this bill going to change the situation with that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, if I understand the question, Adair Village has a long-standing water right undeveloped for which it has an extension request pending. Is that correct?
I understand that.
If that is the case, then Adair Village would be subject to the new requirement that they will not be able to use any further water under that water right until they have an approved water management and conservation plan and until the Water Resources Department is satisfied that it's carrying out that plan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sorry to interrogate you, Rick, but you're the one who brought these forward, so I have a couple questions. I just want to clarify, then, the amendments that you're proposing would apply to any permit extensions that are pending or future permit extension requests.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Yes. So a permit that has been issued, but the city wants to go back and extend that permit, would the amendments apply to an existing permit?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, yes, it would. The way it works is that if you have an existing permit and there is an application for an extension of time pending, then the extension would be subject to these new requirements on what you do on extensions.
Okay, but maybe I stated that wrong. So a municipality that already has an extension, they would be exempt from, I think that's sort of a better question, they would be exempt from what's being proposed in the statute.
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, for existing water rights are protected under the statute, and existing extensions or previously granted extensions are protected.
Okay.
A great many, though, of those extensions are up for renewal.
And that's probably, Mr. Chair, follow-up, probably a better question for Water Resources Department, because
okay.
What I need to see is how many extensions are currently pending versus how many have already been granted and what that means as far as CFS and water that's already been allocated. That would be helpful, and I don't know if the Water Resources Department can address that when they come up, or you can provide that to us later. Just for me to get a handle of how much and how many watersheds we're talking about would be helpful. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Right.
Todd.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Todd Heigerkin, and I'm here really with kind of two hats today. First off, to encourage your support for House Bill 3038 as the chair of the Special Districts of Association's Legislative Committee. And second, and really the primary portion of my testimony will be talking a little bit about municipal water development in my position as the manager of community and intergovernmental relations for the Tualatin Valley Water District in Beaverton, Oregon. For those of you who may not be familiar with Tualatin Valley Water District, we are a municipal water supplier in Washington County that serves more than 190,000 people in our 45-square-mile area. TVWD is a little bit different, where we have two sources of water that are used to meet our current needs of our customers and one additional source that we're in the process of evaluating, and that we have a significant investment in as a potential source in this future. So I want to talk a little bit about how some of the processes that we've gone through and how they fit in with respect to the timeline. During this discussion of municipal water development, I'll be referencing some of the experiences that we've had at Tualatin Valley Water District, especially as it relates to dealing with multiple sources of water, some factors to consider when developing a new water source, and then coordination with the public and other governmental entities as we go along in that process. So first I want to touch on planning. I believe it's important to note that one of our primary functions as municipal water providers is the need to plan for a future water supply. This planning is critical because we have what's known as a duty to serve. It's something that's statutorily required. We have a duty to serve our customers in our service area. Simply put, this means that we have to provide water to those requesting it. We don't have the opportunity or the option to tell people and businesses that there is no water available for them. Land use laws are set up so that water availability is not a limiting factor to growth. In fact, it's apparent when one looks at the moratorium statute, where as a water provider you have, in essence, 1 year. You can ask for an extension of another year before you solve your water problem. So you can't use that as a growth limiting issue. In addition, as governmental entities, which we all are, municipal water suppliers are directly responsible to their constituents. And as so, we must be prudent managers of our financial and environmental resources while making sure the needs of our customers, our public, are met. Beyond this duty to serve that I mentioned, water supply planning is critical to addressing other aspects that we must tackle, such as land use planning, environmental statutes, and bonding or financing requirements. Water providers are involved in a variety of planning. It's reflected in our process to develop a forward-looking water system management plan, master plan, excuse me. The water system master plan looks at our local water system needs for the next 20-plus years. From this master plan, we generate a variety of other planning documents that are necessary to our operation. Things such as our capital improvement plan, how we're going to build our infrastructure and address these future needs. Issues such as our financial plan, how we're going to pay for all these things in the future. In addition, you've heard a little bit about the water management and conservation plan. That's an additional component where a lot of the information that we have to provide, and you're going to hear more about that in the next panel with greater detail. The thing to stress is that these plans are forward-looking documents that are used to identify how we as municipal water suppliers will meet the future demands. However, these plans are only successful in providing us the information we need if we have an ongoing and access to a reliable source of water, i.e., in the form of a water right. So I'd like to note that municipal water suppliers must also plan for great variability in weather patterns that vary each year. I was planning to talk to you about how dry it was, but the rain seemed to take care of that this last week. But the fact of the matter is that's something that we address as water providers and making sure that we can adequately meet the needs of our customers, which include our residents and businesses. Municipalities do not use water that is not needed. However, we do need to plan to provide water during those seasons of high demand. So we need to plan for those peak seasons, especially in the summer. This planning ensures greater reliability to our customers and our businesses. So that's a little on planning. What I want to spend a little bit more time on is actually talking about the development of a water source. It's important that we evaluate each water source for the feasibility of a water supply project. Earlier I mentioned a little bit about what TVWD is currently involved in evaluating the feasibility of developing an additional water source. But an important thing to note is before any physical construction began, we undertook a number of important steps in this process. First, we evaluated the quality of the raw water, the water in the stream. Our initial testing was initiated 7 years prior to any construction. Then we evaluated the best treatment options available for that water source. We operated a pilot water treatment plant and conducted evaluations. Those were conducted 6 years prior to any construction. Our next step was land acquisition. This task involved approximately 6 years of efforts to find a suitable site that could be used for a drinking water treatment facility. Again, this all has to take place before any construction. We also produced a preliminary engineering report to determine how this water source could be developed under various engineering, financial, and governance scenarios. This was completed 2 years prior to any construction occurring. In addition, the engineering that takes place with design and plan, the permitting, and the plan review represents additional actions that, again, need to take place prior to any construction occurring. The important point to note here is that these activities that I've mentioned were conducted only after a water right permit has been granted. You see, it wouldn't have been prudent, in our eyes anyway, to spend the hundreds of thousands of dollars on these activities before knowing if we could actually have a water right that could be secured. Another issue I want to touch briefly on, Mr. Glick's already touched on, is the financing. Of course, all of these activities that I talk about require money, and the largest infusion of money is necessary for the construction phase of the project. However, it's important to note how the financing relates into the activities prior to construction. Traditionally, financing of these capital projects has been for a period of 20 or so years. However, it should be noted that I think financing ranges out to 30-plus years now. As it relates to House Bill 3038, must note that the financing is an additional item that has an effect on our start date of when we can begin construction. And again, it's critical to have that underlying water right in place in order to secure the financing that's necessary. Another component I just want to touch on is that of public involvement. Members of the public have expressed a greater interest in providing input on how a municipal water supplier proceeds with the development of a municipal water source. This public involvement is an important factor that affects the timing associated with the development of that water right. For example, some municipalities have to conduct votes prior to the use of a particular water source. And a minute ago, I talked about financing. It's also important to note that if any revenue bonds are used to finance a water supply project, then these bonds can actually be remonstrated, requiring a public vote also. The public involvement process takes time and is an additional item that needs to be considered prior to construction activities occurring on a water supply project. Another element is that of cooperation with others. A factor that may not be readily apparent, but yet is of great value to municipal water providers, is the opportunity to cooperate amongst each other in the development of an additional water supply source. There are a variety of advantages in doing so, the most obvious being the economies of scale. However, cooperation does take time, and it's something that may require the delay of the development of the water source at that particular point. However, the offset is it's intended to be a more useful and cost-effective water supply development project. Ample time is needed in order to conduct this cooperation, and many times it involves a variety of jurisdictions that have their own governance boards that need to have approval. In our case, with Tualatin Valley Water District, we actually work with four other water providers on one of our sources. We're one of 19 water providers that work with the City of Portland on another source. And we're one of six water providers, or where there's six other water providers that are working on a third source that's being evaluated. So a lot of these things aren't done on our own. We try to take a regional coordination, and it's very important to us. All of these things that I've talked about to this point have been pre-construction activities, but I want to take one moment to talk a little bit about the construction, because I think it's important when we talk about water rights to understand how we construct water supply facilities, and especially with respect to the sizing. Once the planning and other pre-construction activities are complete, obviously it's time to construct. However, construction brings up some interesting challenges that again impact the development of the water right. Water systems are designed and constructed to be in service for extended periods of time. We don't build a project to last 10 or 20 years. Water lines are intended to last anywhere from between 50 and 100 years.
The challenge is to balance the fact that a water provider wants to avoid overbuilding a facility or extending the water system prematurely because of the financial burden on its ratepayers. However, we do not want to put an expensive water line in the ground or build an expensive water treatment plant where that will be available only to serve intermediate needs and not be available to be serve long-term needs and therefore have to replace it before it's at the end of its useful life. The way we address this is by sizing the different components of the water supply system differently. And for example, let me just throw out a couple examples. The main transmission or supply lines that are kind of thought of as the backbone of a water supply system are often sized in for long-term service. I've mentioned 100 or 50 to 100 years in the future. Major supply projects, such as a dam, obviously that has a very long period of time that is factored into the planning, 100 years or more. With a drinking water treatment plant, it actually has different components, so that maybe the intake to the treatment plant and the outlet piping of the treatment plant are sized to be the ultimate capacity of what you envision that treatment plant to be, again, to meet those long-term needs. However, the treatment plant components may be sized to have to serve more of the intermediate needs or the increments there. So I've touched on a variety of different things that that are involved in water system planning. I've tried to provide you with a flavor of some of the activities that need to be conducted prior to the physical construction of the facilities necessary to use municipal water rights. I think the important part is that we're asking the legislature to, in essence, validate what we've been doing for decades and to continue to allow us to develop the municipal water rights as we've been told we can. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the committee taking time on this issue.
Thank you, Ted. Are there questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay. We have what we were checking on, colleagues, was whether the other panel that Mr. Tiffany has put together will be available to come back on Wednesday, and they indicate that they will be, so we'll move to what somewhat appears to be the other side of the story. Brian Fosterwitz, is that correct? Karen Russell, and is it Ed Gowan?
Patrick?
Yeah. Okay. Have you been able to hear okay?
Perfect.
Okay. So do you want to stay on the line or?
I could.
That's up to you.
I am available.
Thank you, sir.
We'll keep you here.
Okay.
Please go
ahead. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear today. My name is Brian Posowitz. I'm the current board president of Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch is a nonprofit organization founded in 1985. The mission of Water Watch is to speak up for the value that water has when it's left flowing in Oregon's streams and rivers. That water is valuable to Oregonians because it provides scenery and recreation. It is also valuable because it allows for fish and wildlife that all Oregonians enjoy. I am also an attorney in private practice, and in that capacity I represented Water Watch in the case that you've heard referenced a couple of times today, that Coos Bay case. House Bill 3038 deals in general with how far in advance of actual water use, how far in advance of actual need, a municipal water supplier ought to be able to obtain a permit for that water. This seems like to some extent, an arcane technical point of water law, but it is, in fact, a very important issue. It's an issue that will have a very significant impact about how the water demands of future growth in Oregon are balanced against other interests of other water users, and interests of preserving water in the stream. In considering this issue, it's important to keep in mind that state water law attempts to balance the interest of an out-of-stream appropriation against other interests by conducting a public interest analysis that occurs at the time an appropriation permit is issued. By allowing too much time to pass after an appropriation permit is issued, before the water is actually put to use, what ends up happening is that actual water use can occur based on a public interest analysis that has become outdated. The past practice of the Oregon Water Resources Department and the municipal water suppliers has been to allow municipal water suppliers to obtain an appropriation permit far, far in advance of any likely actual use of the water, sometimes 50 years in advance. The way that's been accomplished in general is an appropriation permit is issued. It's under the statute supposed to be developed in 5 years, and then the Water Resources Department grants an extension of time to develop it, sometimes for as long as 50 years. You've heard the earlier panel testify that all they're trying to do is continue past practice. We think their bill actually would expand on that to some extent, but we think past practice is very, very bad water policy that should not be continued. The result of the past practice is an astounding number of very old water appropriation permits that have never been put to use, but that could be put to use today without any evaluation of whether it makes sense. After many, many years, after changes in values, after changes in needs, after new information. It also has resulted in new permits being issued today for uses far, far in the future, sometimes 50 years in the future, without any real opportunity to say before that day gets here, hey, this doesn't really make sense anymore, given what we know now, given what alternatives we know are available, and so forth. It also has resulted in a stockpiling of water permits. The testimony you heard earlier it was characterized as municipalities only really getting the permits they're really, really going to need, that they really plan to develop in 20 years, and they just need time to do their financing and planning and so forth. We don't think that's what really has happened. We think what's happened is a big stockpiling of permits that are not likely to ever be put to use. My written testimony contains an Exhibit 1. And I'd like to talk about that for just a minute. We requested data from the Water Resources Department. We asked them for a list of all issued permits for municipal water use for which there has not been a certificate obtained. What ordinarily happens after someone gets an appropriation permit is they put the water to use, with ordinarily within a five-year period. Then they go back to the state and they say, look, I've put it to use. They prove they've used the water. Then they get a certificate, and the certificate is what constitutes the water right. The list in Exhibit 1 is a list of just the permits for which no certificate has been sought. And there's a lot of qualifications to this data, which I think the Water Resources will explain, and I perhaps don't fully understand, but in general, what it provides is a rough look at the extent to which municipalities have obtained water appropriation permits and held them for a very long time without ever actually putting the water to use. The list, by the way, is organized, is ordered according to priority date, which is the date that the application was filed, the oldest permits first. And I've only included on this list the permits with a priority date before 1985. So what this is, in essence, is a list of water appropriation permits that are today more than 20 years old, for which there has never been any proof of actual use, or at least no attempt to obtain a certificate. I should rephrase that. There has not been a certificate issued, which ordinarily is what happens after actual use is proven. And I want to point out one thing about municipalities that is a little bit unique. The law allows a municipality to obtain a certificate for less than the total amount of water allowed under its permit. And the statute says an amount not less than 25%. What that's intended to reflect is the understanding that municipalities need to obtain permits for more water than they're likely to use right off the bat. And they can do that, and we don't have any objection to that. But what would happen is they would say they would need 10 CFS. They'd in the near future, they would apply for 40. They would be entitled to go to the Water Resources Department after using 10, get a certificate for that 10, and keep the remaining 30. This list, my understanding is, does not cover those situations. It's permits for which there has never been a certificate obtained. I added up, and this is data we received fairly recently from the Water Resources Department, and so it's possible I've made some mistake in analyzing this, and hopefully Water Resources can clarify that. But when I add up the cubic feet per second under permits more than 20 years old, and I convert that to millions of gallons of water per day, or when I convert that to gallons of water per day, I get about 2 billion gallons of water per day under permits more than 20 years old for which no certificate has been obtained. To put that in perspective, according to the City of Portland's website, the average daily demand for the City of Portland is about 106 million gallons a day. So the amount of water that is being reserved by municipalities under permits for which no certificate has been obtained, if you go based on the Portland average, is about 20 times what Portland needs. And in fairness, Portland has a peak demand, according to their website, of about 200 million gallons a day, but the amount of water reserved is about 10 times what's necessary to satisfy that. Now, I want to talk about just a couple of examples. And again, the problem Water Watch has with these old permits being held and not used in a reasonable time is that the only analysis of whether they're in the public interest occurred when the permit was issued. So the problem is that what can happen today is all of a sudden a proposed use under one of these old permits will rear its head, and there will be no chance to say, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. You're going to devastate a public resource. You're not doing all you can to conserve. There are alternative sources you're not considering. Our concern is that we can't raise those issues under these old permits.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So some of these permits that went back to the early part of the 20th century, there would not be another hearing. They would just be able to get their permit. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, my understanding of it is that, I mean, we don't know, for example, what the extension status of those is. But let's say, for example, under an old permit, that they got the permit, that there was an extension given sometime in the past, and again, those extensions can be for as long as 50 years. My understanding of the law is they could put those to use without any attempt, without any further public interest analysis or public participation about that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes. Now, I want to talk just about a couple of examples of where this issue has reared its head and given us concern. On the southern Oregon coast, the city of Brookings and the Harbor Rural Water District are now seek extensions to develop water appropriations from the Chetco River. And they're doing it under three permits dated from 61 to 78, in our view, very old permits. They want to develop those permits, even though doing so...
Okay, we just disconnected him.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, that's why we had the conference call. Go ahead.
Sorry, I'll go.
No, no.
Sorry, I didn't know that was hooked up to the line.
Go ahead.
We turned it off.
Thank you. I'll start over with the Chetco River example. What we have there are the city of Brookings and a water district with old permits, 61 to 78, that want to now are saying they now want to develop water or take water out of the Chetco River, even though doing that could wipe out a run of native Chinook salmon. In central Oregon, the city of Bend wants to withdraw water under a 1968 groundwater permit. And if it is, if it's able to do so, it will not be subject to rules that were enacted later that are designed to require mitigation when groundwater has a detrimental, when groundwater withdrawals have a detrimental impact on scenic flows in the Deschutes River. So the point is, by virtue of the old permit and extracting water under the old permit without a further public interest analysis, they avoid those rules. The another example is in this, on the central Oregon coast, the Kernville Glen Eden Water District wants to use appropriation permits dated 1963 and 1970 to take water from Drift Creek, which is a valuable salmon and steelhead stream. They can't use all of that water, and their intention is to sell some of it to Lincoln City. But again, it's an example of an old permit under which water use could be allowed today without, we think, without adequate evaluation of whether it's still in the public interest.
Mr. Chair?
I'm going to represent tonight.
Oh, are you sure? Okay. You skipped Adair Village, which is one of the ones that I asked. Could you talk
about
that?
I was going
to
mention that next.
Okay.
And let me say, what I know about Adair Village is that they have a 1971 permit to take water from the Willamette River, and it's for approximately 80 cubic feet per second of water. And my understanding is they're using something less than two. And so, and that my understanding also is that they're saying what we ought to be able to do now is to take this big old water right we've got and market this water to the surrounding community. But what that is to us is an example of getting a permit for water way beyond reasonably anticipated need and being able to hang on to it under this past practice of issuing permits way in advance of actual needs and extending them for long, long periods of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I'm going to interrupt your testimony. I've just recognized that Ed is from a distance in excess of 100 miles from the Capitol, and considerably more than 100 miles, if I understand the geography correctly. And allow him to go ahead with your testimony at this time.
Chair Jensen, I appreciate that. And since most of my testimony is written and you have a copy of that, I will just summarize the end and leave the rest of the time to my colleagues. Chair Jensen and the rest of the committee. My name is Ed Gowan. I live at 830 Rachel Road in Lakeside, Oregon. 97449. I am the mayor of Lakeside, and I represent the city and the surrounding areas that could have some development coming their way shortly. We would like to ask that the committee consider a task force that would be used to develop what the water quality standards are and exactly what the water quality amounts would be. These long-term permits that are being held for many years, such as the one that the Coos Bay North Bend Water Board has been arguing over on 10 Mile Creek for over a decade now, the amount of water that they were professing to have in that creek is no longer there. It's that information that they were using is over 50 years old. And there's no adequate data to date that shows any of the strain on what has happened to the ecological system that could have an impact on actual water use. We feel that it's time that the state take hold of its own water resources and actually find out how much is available before issuing any permits. I think the permits should be based upon if there's going to be actually water there. I'm sure 15, 20 years ago, the stream coming through 10 Mile Creek was very adequate and would probably have handled to excess what the city of Coos Bay North Bend is requiring. However, at this time, there is not the water there in that creek. You're doing good to get a 25 or even a 30 CSF flow through that creek at this time. There's also a tributary to that creek, which is Eel Creek, which runs out of Eel Lake, which is also Lakeside's water drinking water. Eel Creek has just been designated a stream fishing by for steelhead fishing, which has been handled by our STEP program in our city. And we would hate to see and then something happen to that progress that has been made with the fish reinstating into the stream. We feel that water data should be required on an ongoing basis, considering water quality, volume, and quantity, and other considerations required by Water Resource Department. The pressure for clean water will be increasing over the years, and right at this point, considering this bill, there is no emergency for this bill. There's plenty of time to consider the things that, such as a task force that would shape responsible public policy for the rest of the century concerning water issues in the state of Oregon. I will end this, and I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to me, and hope you'll take the concerns of the city of Lakeside to heart when you make your recommendations toward this hastily prepared legislation. It is no more than a band-aid solution masking the true underlying issue of a resolution to the complex problems of municipal water rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. And again, my apologies. It is normally the practice of this committee and of the legislature to take those people from out further than 100 miles before anyone else, and we just simply goofed. We're running quickly out of time, and I have a question, I guess. Karen, were you going to? Are you listening, or are you just here for the professional support, or?
All of the above. Right?
Yeah. I had a few comments, but, you know, I can, if you're going to be rescheduling,
we will be.
I can be present on Wednesday.
We'll be continuing on Wednesday, and we've got a couple of minutes left. If you'd like to leave us at some point, or if you're at a point of stopping now, why, we can just call it a day and come back on Wednesday, or what, your choice.
Could I just have a minute to wrap up?
Please.
Okay. Thank you. I want to talk about the Coos Bay case just a little bit. The Coos Bay case was the Coos Bay North Bend Water Board applying for a permit to take water from Ten Mile Creek, which runs out of Ten Mile Lake, which is where the city of Lakeside is located. They applied for the permit to take water from Ten Mile Creek, even though they already had about double the water they needed to meet existing demands. And they said they wanted the water from Ten Mile Creek at the earliest by 2025, and the record showed it probably wouldn't be needed until 2050. Water Watch challenged that because Water Watch believes the past practice that the sponsors or that the proponents of the bill want to enact is bad water policy. And our point was essentially the kinds of points that the mayor was making, which is we don't know what the world is going to look like 50 years from now when you actually might use this water. You shouldn't get a permit today based on a public interest analysis today without an opportunity to consider before you actually put the water to use whether that still makes sense. So I wanted just to comment briefly on the proposed legislation. So Water Watch recognizes that municipal water suppliers are in a unique position and that they have to be able to plan ahead for their water use. However, legislation to address their needs also should recognize that facts and values change drastically over periods as long as 50 years and even over periods as long as 20 years. We think what's necessary to recognize that is that there be a definite time limit between issuance of a permit and putting water to use. They've now proposed 20 years, which was not in the original bill. We believe 10 years is more appropriate. We also believe that there ought to be a time limit for extensions of that initial time period to develop the water. That is not in their proposal, even as amended. To us, it doesn't make sense to say you get 10 years from issuance of a permit to develop your permit,
But at the end of that, we can give you an extension for some unlimited, unspecified period of time. We think that needs to be limited to no longer than the initial time period. So in the interest of time, I will wrap up and thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and let me know if you have any other questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we will be continuing this bill on Wednesday. I have a question. I'm not necessarily looking for an answer right now, but something that comes to mind when you object to 20 and are somewhat agreeable to 10. It's my understanding that as far as municipalities are concerned, that in relationship to other laws and activities, they tend to be kind of on a 20-year planning sort of cycle. So I need to think a little bit about why we'd be proposing something different as far as the water is concerned from, say, their land use that they'd have with it. It's strikes me as odd that we would want to propose. It looked like consistency might be more meaningful in the statutes, but if you'd like to speak to that, fine. If you'd like not to, that's fine. We'll visit it again on Wednesday.
Okay. I'll just respond very briefly. I'm not sure I have a perfect answer to that question. I would just want to point out that from our perspective, we're also looking at what is the appropriate period of time after which you might have reason to believe that the public interest analysis you did when the permit was issued is no longer, it has become outdated, and our view would be 10 years seems like a reasonable time for that. I also wanted to note that there are other statutes, for example, ORS 537.248 provides for reservoir permits to counties, municipalities, and special districts. That provides a 10-year development time period and a 10-year limit on extensions of that period.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll see you on Wednesday, I think. Is there anyone that was signed up that is unable to return on Wednesday? Okay. Very good. With that, we are over time right now. We are... wait a minute, I'm being told something. To close the public hearing on House Bill 3038. And am I doing anything else wrong? Okay, we're adjourned.